Want to pull off the season's freshest trends? You just need the right shoes. That's where Designer Shoe Warehouse comes in. Loving wide-leg jeans? Pair them with sleek, low-profile sneakers. Obsessed with the sheer trend? Try it with mesh flats. Feeling boho? Comfy sandals nail the whole free-spirited thing. Find on-trend shoes from the brands you love, like Birkenstock, Nike, Adidas, and more at DSW.
We have a U.S. Open coming to Pittsburgh, and that'll be at Oakmont Country Club the week of June 9th. And boy, it has hosted 9 U.S. Opens before. This will be number 10 most ever. 6 U.S. Amateurs, 6, or make that 3 PGA Championships, and 2 Women's Open. And most recently has been named an anchor site, which means you're going to see a lot more of Oakmont coming up. And a man who knows everything about the tournament history, the nooks and crannies of the golf course, is joining me right now. His name is David Moore, and he is a historian at Oakmont, and we had the pleasure of doing a television interview with him, and we're going to have a special on KDK TV. It's going to be a good one, in depth about the history. And David, good morning. I appreciate you joining me.
Hey, Bob. Thanks for having me. Great to talk to you again.
Always a pleasure, and I know you know a lot about this. I want to just start with the changes to this place, based on what we've seen in the past. This is a Fones golf course, to take us all the way back to the beginning. This is the one and only golf course that Henry Fones designed. How did it come to be that he was the designer and this was it? What made him get into the game of golf the way he did?
So Henry was introduced to the game around 1894 when golf first came to Pittsburgh. Like most of the wealthy elite at the Gilded Age of the 20th century, turn of the 20th century there, Henry Fones was involved in iron and steel. In fact, he and his brother owned the Cary Furnace Company over there in Rankin, which is now part of the Rivers of Steel Tour. And, Henry was introduced to golf by another steel guy named John Moorhead, who ended up founding Allegheny Country Club in 1895. And then in 1898, Henry sells the Cary Furnace to Andrew Carnegie for what I'm sure was an obscene amount of money in that day and age. And essentially what went on was Henry kind of fell in love with the game and he took to it real quick. And there was a health scare that he endured there for a little period of time right after the sale of the Cary Furnace. And when he kind of got this new, this clearance, this new lease on life, he was, in his mid-40s. He was flush with cash after selling the Cary Furnace to Carnegie. And he had this new lease on life, and he kind of devoted his life to the game. And he set out around 1901, 1902 to build his own golf course. And after a search of about a year or two, he came across the property in Oakmont, 191 acres. And he and a group of investors bought it for $78,500, which is about $3 million today. And Oakmont Country Club was officially established that June of 1903. And that fall... Oh, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, so I remember his idea was make it sort of like a Scottish links course, right? So you had no Correct. Trees back then.
Correct. So the property, when Henry purchases it, was, not much different than what you'll see in a couple weeks when you're walking the grounds. It was rolling farmland, not a lot of trees. And, Henry was definitely inspired by the classic links courses of Scotland and Ireland and Great Britain. Your old courses, Prestwick, Musselburgh, North Berwick, places like that. And so when he came back here, he wanted to design a golf course very similar to that. And that's exactly what he did on the rolling hills there in Oakmont. And it opened up the following year in October of 1904, played at about 6,406 yards and a par of 80. And for those that have played it, and I'm sure there will be a handful of pros in a couple weeks that will wish it still was a par 80 because they'll have a much better score.
I don't think there's any question. And it's funny how it's transformed over time. At some point, somebody decided in the 1950s, we need some trees here. This is not exactly what it should be. And so they started a tree planting process. And then all of a sudden, more recently after the 1994 thing, I think, they removed all the trees. So it's like fashion, isn't it? It comes and goes.
It does. So after the 53 U.S. Open, Herbert Warren Wynne for the New Yorker wrote that Oakmont was an ugly old brute of a golf course. And the board was so infuriated by his use of the term ugly that they planted some 5,000 trees on the golf course, which completely changed what, you know, Henry Fones had created. It was meant to be a Scottish links course, and the planting of all the trees turned it into, you know, a more Parkland style course, similar to Augusta National or Pinehurst number 2 or places like that. And, you know, the trees grew up for about 30, 35, 40 years. And after the 94 US Open, there was a concerted effort of, you know, not only was it done to help promote better turf growth, but, you know, a photograph, an aerial photograph from the 40s was found, or early 50s, and it showed the golf course with no trees on it. And, you know, our board at the time realized that, you know, this is what Henry intended this place to be. It was supposed to play like a links course. It wasn't supposed to be, you know, like Augusta National. So, you know, they made the decision around the year 2000, let's start cutting down trees. And now it's, you know, truly a links course. The only thing it's missing is an ocean nearby. But if you want to count the Allegheny River, you can, I suppose.
Yeah, it's fascinating. David Moore, our special guest here, Oakmont historian. And I'm going to go back. You know, there have been 9 U.S. Opens here, David. So I want to pick your brain on some of the big things that stand out from each. The first one was 1927. Tommy Armour wins the thing. And I couldn't believe the final score. Tell us what, you know, it was plus 13 to win the event. What's your biggest takeaway from that event?
Well, it was 13 over par. I think his final score was 301, which is the last U.S. Open to finish with a over 300 score. You know, the one thing to keep in mind about back then is, you know, that golf course played at 6,900 yards for that open. Most golf courses were not playing anywhere near that long. They're playing with hickory shafted irons and woods and persimmon drivers. And, you know, that was before the days of, you know, the more modern persimmons. And it's the first rubber core golf ball. So, you know, you're kind of playing with, you know, not the technology that the guys play with today. So that certainly played a major role in the score that week. The weather was also, you know, a little cooler. There was some rain early in the week. So that certainly made it even longer and more difficult to traverse. And, you know, when Tommy won, you know, Tommy was really kind of the, you know, an afterthought. Nobody really kind of counted him amongst the favorites, even though he would go on to a Hall of Fame career. Everybody expected Bobby Jones to come in and walk away with that open as the reigning U.S. Open and reigning British Open champion. And, you know, he had won the U.S. Amateur at Oakmont just 2 years earlier. And he ended up having his worst career finish in the U.S. Open in 1927. And it's the only time in his 13 career starts he finished outside of the top 10. He finished in the tie for 11th. So just unbelievable.
Next time I was here was 1935, and that's where we had a very interesting story from a local golf pro who happened to be at South Hills Country Club, I believe. Tell us about 1935.
Yeah, so, you know, if you read about the U.S. Open and read these history books, they'll always kind of call Sam Parks, you know, the ultimate dark horse champion in U.S. Open history. And, you know, he probably was among those. You know, Francis We Met probably was a bigger dark horse at the time, but, you know, he went on to do what he went on to do. Sam was born in Bellevue, grew up there, got his first golf lesson in 1922 from Gene Saracen while he was here as a pro for one season. Fell in love with the game, ended up captaining the University of Pittsburgh golf team in 1929-1930. Graduated and turned professional, and he was at South Hills for the 1935 U.S. Open and for about a decade or so after that as well. And, you know, the key to Sam's success was, you know, he came over and he practiced in the mornings with our pro and greenkeeper, really learned the golf course. And, you know, he was definitely a dark horse on the national scene, but a lot of the local guys knew the preparation that Sam had put into, you know, competing in that Open. And, you know, the locals were not nearly as surprised as the rest of the world when Sam raised the trophy at the tournament's end.
At a plus 11 winning score, still a beast of a golf course. And that continued in 1953. I always found this interesting story as we speak with David Moore, a historian at Oakmont, because I remember reading in depth about how Ben Hogan nearly died. He and his wife were in some sort of horrific crash, and he actually could have died. Many said, well, he's lucky to be alive. And then 4 years later comes back and he wins at the U.S. Open at Oakmont. That has to be one of the most amazing comebacks. You talk about comebacks in sports all the time, ever.
Absolutely. What Ben Hogan did after that accident, for those that don't know the story, real quick, He was driving home from a tournament in Arizona or West Texas, back to Dallas-Fort Worth, where he was where he lived, and him and his wife were hit head-on by a Greyhound bus. And had he not dove across the seat to protect his wife, he would have been killed instantly. And instead, he suffered a double fracture of his pelvis, broken collarbone, broken ankle, and developed blood clots in his legs, which required a, you know, a kind of risky surgery at the time. He cut off the vena cava in his leg, and that alleviated the blood clots. But then Mr. Hogan dealt with swelling and pain really for the remainder of his life. But what's so fascinating is, you know, just 15 months after that horrible accident, he won the U.S. Open in Marion. And six of his nine major victories came after the accident.
Wow.
And his final U.S. Open triumph was at Oakmont in 1953 when he went wire-to-wire to defeat Sam Snead by six shots.
What an amazing story that is. And nobody would have ever thought that he would walk again, let alone win at Oakmont, this brutal golf course. Then we move ahead to 1962, and this is one of the favorite ones. Dom, our producer, you're listening to this. I hope you're a golf fan, because David has great stories. 1962 became a battle of the local legend Arnold Palmer against Jack Nicklaus, who had zero majors coming into this one. Tell us about the biggest takeaway of that one.
Well, everybody expected Arnie to come in and walk away with that championship. All the newspapers said that, you know, this was going to be the year of the Grand Slam, the first time the modern Grand Slam would be completed in 1 year of winning the Masters, the U.S. Open, the British Open, and the PGA Championship. And Arnie was off to a great start. He had won the Masters in April. In fact, he had won about five or six times on tour coming into the U.S. Open that week. But Sunday before the championship started, he actually sliced his ring finger getting his luggage out of his airplane in La Trobe Airport, and it required some stitches. And I personally feel it probably had a big effect on him, because he ended up three putting 11 times that week, which, you know, if he would have three putted maybe, you know, three or four times, he probably would have won by four or five shots overall. And you know, unfortunately, that opened the door for Jack. And Jack was a 22-year-old rookie on the PGA Tour. He had yet to win a single major. He had yet to win a single PGA Tour event. And, you know, everybody was expecting Arnie to win, but Arnie had actually told the press that, you know, watch out for that big kid from Ohio. He's got the game to win here. And, you know, come Sunday, Jack was the U.S. Open champion.
And you told me an interesting story that you think, because of Arnie's army, it actually backfired for Arnold, right? I mean, those people were so rooting for Arnold that they kind of disrespected Jack Nicklaus in the process.
Correct. It was truly, if the Ravens were playing the Steelers at Heinz Field, you know, for the AFC Championship, it was that kind of crowd that came out in support of Arnie during the 1962 U.S. Open. And I 100% believe it backfired. You know, Mr. Palmer was always such a gentleman, and there's, you know, stories of how he stopped play on numerous occasions to kind of calm the fans down and put them back in their place, because, you know, Jack was, you know, a 22-year-old kid. He was a little pudgier in those days. And, you know, they were, you know, the fans were yelling out at him, calling him Fat Jack and Fat Boy. And, you know, they booed him when he made a birdie, and they cheered when he made a bogey. And, you know, what they were really thinking they were doing was helping Arnie, you know, on his charge for the Grand Slam. And in reality, you know, the gentleman that he was, it really unnerved him and had the opposite effect. If they would have been, you know, a little better behaved, I'm sure Arnie probably would have played a little better.
Yeah, that's fascinating to me. And the thing about slicing your finger, too, bad timing on that one. 11 three-putts, that just didn't happen with Arnold back then. We move along then to 1973. This is one of the tournaments that people talk about the most, only because of what happened in the final round. But Johnny Miller thought he had played himself out of contention in the third round, and then what happened?
So Johnny got to the tee box, first tee, a Saturday afternoon, opened up his golf bag and realized that he had left his yardage book on his nightstand in his hotel room. And, you know, as Johnny would tell you, you know, you never, as a professional, you never want to fly blind on any golf course, especially during a major championship, but you definitely don't want to do it at Oakmont during a U.S. Open. So he sent his wife Linda back to the hotel, but by the time she traversed traffic and the crowds there and back, you know, Johnny got through the front nine. He shot 38, and, you know, he ended up shooting 76 on Saturday, and he thought, well, I'm out of this. I'm six shots back. And the guys he had to leapfrog had won a combined 35 major championships to that point. Arnold Palmer, Julius Burroughs, Jack Nicklaus, Gary Player, Lee Trevino, and Tom Weisskopf, who hadn't won a major yet but was on his way to doing so later that year. And Johnny really thought, well, I'll go out, shoot a score, hopefully, you know, make a decent check and get out of town. In fact, he told his wife to stay behind, pack up the room so we can make a quick getaway. And he started birdie, 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 and four holes in, he was only two shots back, and Arnie and Julius Burrows hadn't even teed off yet. And he thought, well, you know, golly, I'm right back in this. And ended up making only one bogey on the day at the par 3 eighth. He three-putted from about 25 feet. And then he made birdies at 11, 12, 13, and 15, which is, you know, a pretty difficult stretch of that golf course, and ended up shooting that magical 63. And it was enough to win by one shot over a guy named John Schley and two shots over Arnie and Julius Burrows.
Amazing. And who would have thought? But you, that goes to show you, you never know. Starting Oakmont, birdie, 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 final round. Man, one of the best rounds ever in the history of major championship golf. David Moore, our special guest, Oakmont historian, 1983, Larry Nelson wins. And he had to make a, if I remember this correctly, because I remember being out there, but it was one of the longest putts, and I forget what hole it was on, that nobody expected. They were talking about three putting, and here he made one.
Yeah, so Larry barely made the cut that week and then proceeded to shoot the best final 36-hole score in U.S. Open history to date. And on Sunday, actually it went into Monday when this event happened because a rainstorm came through and postponed play Sunday evening. So Larry goes out and, you know, he hits a, you know, an okay tee shot on the long par 3-16th. He leaves himself about a 45-footer double breaker and, you know, like you said, he's hoping just to get up and down two putt and get out without making a mistake. And he somehow drains this 45 footer and, you know, he kind of trots after it and, you know, has the swagger going there. And it propelled him to a one shot victory over Tom Watson, who came into the final nine holes of that championship up by five or six shots and just kind of, you know, gave a couple away before the rainstorm postponed things. And, you know, when it came to, finishing up on Monday, he shot a 38 on the back, and that was it. Larry Nelson was your champion.
And then 11 years later, comes back to Oakmont in extreme heat, as I recall this one, going out there trying to cover it. We went through shirt after shirt after shirt. I saw guys dropping out, 97 every day. And then we had a three-man playoff, it turns out, with Colin Montgomery, Ernie Els, who really, I think, catapulted this into the national scene, and then Lauren Roberts. But my biggest takeaway from this is Arnold Palmer walking up 18 for the very final time of his amazing career, and the emotions that I felt myself, everyone was crying. I've never seen anything like it in the post-game press conference as well.
Yeah, the you know, the 94 Open is, you know, unfortunately for Ernie, it really was a springboard for his career, but it's always kind of overshadowed by it being Mr. Palmer's final U.S. Open. And you know, he was given a special exemption by the USGA to compete. He would end up missing the cut. But, you know, it's one of those things, you know, it's kind of like the Mazeroski home run. It's kind of like the Immaculate Reception. Like, everybody will tell you they were there for Arnie's final round kind of thing. You know, it was one of those iconic Pittsburgh sports moments that, you know, everybody, you know, claims to be a part of. And, you know, Mr. Palmer is such a special man, so important to the history of the game and really where the game is today. You know, you could say, you know, would golf be what it is without Arnold Palmer? And I think the answer without a hesitation is no. You know, I mean, he really revolutionized the game. He made it accessible and cool for, you know, blue-collar players and everybody in between. So, you know, for him to get to say goodbye to that championship, you know, on a course near his hometown, it meant the world to him, and I'm sure it meant the world to, you know, every golf fan out there.
Yeah, that ended up being a three-man 18-hole playoff, which then needed two more holes of a playoff before Ernie Els ends up winning that one over Lauren Roberts. It was, again, tremendous. 2007, nobody thought Angel Cabrera was going to win. Tiger Woods was in the field, and I thought everyone just fait accompli, well, it's Tiger, he's going to win. He had a chance. What happened?
Well, you know, the church pew struck. You know, that was the big problem with Tiger's round was the third hole that day. Everybody kind of points to 17 where he missed the birdie putt and only made par, and then he missed the birdie putt to tie again on 18. But he doubled number three that day. He found the pews, pitched out, ended up pitching long of the green, and then got it up and down to, you know, make double bogey. But, you know, when all was said and done, that was the two shots he needed to win outright. And, you know, everybody did expect Tiger to win. And then if it wasn't going to be Tiger, everybody hoped it was going to be Jim Furyk with his Pittsburgh and Pennsylvania ties. And, you know, Jim made the big mistake on 17. He made bogey. And, you know, Cabrera, even though he bogeyed two holes coming in, he was definitely the more steady hand, and he shot, you know, one of the very few under par rounds that week. In fact, there was only 8 rounds under par the entire championship, and Cabrera shot 2 of them.
Wow. And the winning score was +5, so it's still a tough venue for sure. In 2016, which is the last time I was here, David Moore, our special guest here from Oakmont, the historian, Dustin Johnson. The one thing you say about Dustin Johnson winning that thing is he was unnerved by anything that would have happened that week. He seems that way naturally, and it seemed to have helped him in this tournament.
Yeah, I mean, Dustin is just, you know, he has this mentality about him, this you know, it's just personality, I guess, too. He just seems so laid back and unflappable. And, you know, if he makes a mistake, he makes a mistake. He's not going to get too up. He's not going to get too down. And, you know, that final round he came in, he was back a couple shots of Shane Lowry, who was the 54-hole leader. And, you know, Dustin went out and he played extremely well. He made a bunch of birdies. And, you know, the big issue came at the fifth hole, the par 4, where, you know, he's about to putt and he thinks his ball moves. And he calls the official in. He calls Lee Westwood, his playing partner, in. And, you know, he says, guys, I think the ball moved, but I didn't touch it. And, you know, both the official and Lee made the call that, you know, you're good, go ahead. And, you know, a couple holes later, he was informed that there might be a penalty. And, you know, that kind of would have unnerved most people. And, you know, Dustin proceeded to, you know, pipe it right down the 12th fairway and play the last 6 holes 1 under par after he was told that there could be a penalty. And, you know, when all was said and done, he was raising the trophy by ultimately 3 shots because the penalty was in fact enforced, but would have been 4 shots had it not been. And, you know, it's just a testament to him. He went on to win the Masters a couple years later and, you know, has really been one of the best players of his generation.
David, I know you have a lot going on. I really do appreciate the time, but I think people who didn't understand maybe the history of some of these great events certainly did over the last 20 minutes. I really do thank you for your time. And again, we'll be featuring David in a special we have on KDK TV coming up prior to the tournament, and you'll be able to see some of these things we've been talking about. Dave, thank you very much. Appreciate the time, man.
Anytime, Bob. Thank you very much for promoting us and promoting our history.
Absolutely. All right, David, thank you. That's David Moore.